This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Thanks for tuning into the Urban Political podcast today. This is Markus Kipp, and I'm joined by Ross Beveridge and Philipp Weitze today. And we briefly framed this episode that brings together four researchers and activists who reflect on urban planning paradigms in places of the so-called Global South. Our guests will reflect on avenues for decolonizing and decentering planning approaches and discuss the role of academic research. Our moderator today is Inge John, a lecturer in international urban politics at the University of Melbourne. And Inge speaks with, in the alphabetical order, Mark Davidson, a professor of urban geography in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University, Prince Guma, a research fellow and assistant country director at the British Institute in Eastern Africa, Nairobi, and Smuti Jukur, an urbanist based in India, currently the program leader at the Society for the Promotion of Area Resource Center, SPARC, which is an affiliate of the Transnational Slum Dwellers International Network. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Really looking forward to learning from you. Inge, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Markus. Hi, everyone, and thank you, Prince, for inviting me to be a moderator of this discussion. I myself don't have the extensive research experience in southern cities, and I actually had a personal failure doing a research in Nepal when I was a PhD student, which we can talk about later. So I'm really excited to learn from you guys as a moderator today. And just to give you a bit of background, as in where I'm coming from and how I come up with the questions I'm planning to ask today, my research interests kind of in this topic, around this topic, on what does academic research have to offer for developing an alternative planning approach, an approach that does justice to the urban realities of the South. The research interest that I have began when I was having a conversation with a practitioner working for peri-urban settlement communities in Latin America. When I asked her what she thought about UN's work on SDGs, she was a bit hesitant about it becoming the unilateral standard that determines what's a good development. Her reason was that the standards don't always reflect the realities experienced and felt by the actual inhabitants, and that the citizens, not the morality from on high, should determine what works for them, as well as how to fight against the forces that endanger the actualization of their own ideals. And this was one of the reasons why my recent commentary on The City We Want, published in Planning Theory and Practice, I emphasize on the contextual specificities of normative directions in collective action. Drawing from geographer Robert Lake's idea of situated justice, I argued against transcendent values in defense of evolving values that only come alive in actual practices of social actors. Relatedly, Prince, present here today, in his recent article on provisional urban worlds, argues that, quote, urban planners and practitioners need to open up to urban worlds whose materializations exceed unidimensional conceptions of modernity, and to incorporate the reality of provisional urban worlds into official city making and planning, recognizing the value of these informal and transient structures in people's lives, unquote. So the theme that we try to delve into today, which is how can academic research be of service to envisioning alternative planning agendas that reflect the realities of South, entails these three key concerns. The first concern is regard to epistemological contentions between theory and practice. So Mark, present here today, noted in his recent article, Going Bust in Two Ways, published in Urban Geography. He argues that on the one hand, there are theoretical explorations that are invested in critiquing exploitative social processes caused by larger political economic systems, such as neoliberalism and capitalism. And on the other hand, there's practitioner space, which is often filled with applying or challenging regulatory confinements of everyday city making. So this is the first issue. The second issue concerns who then decides what's a good or bad development, or what's a good or bad policy. And this question has been well noted by Prince's work on incompleteness of urban infrastructure, where he discusses the contextually post-Western heterogeneous modernities and technicities. And finally, if academia is about knowledge production, that could not only help us understand our world a little bit better, but also become useful for our practical engagement with the world, either through redescriptions, critical reflections, or collective inquiries, how do we address the tension between our scholarly pursuits, which is often driven by, you know, theories, etc., versus having an actual relevance to the life conditions of everyday communities? And what does it take for urban research or academic research to be useful for reimagining or reinventing new practices? So we're going to talk about three topics, and I'm trying to cap 20 minutes per topic. I'm going to pose prompt questions to each speakers, but anybody can jump in and ask a follow-up question. I will look at the time and make sure that we do that 20 minutes per topic. So first topic is epistemological contentions. Second topic is how to decide what is good or bad planning or development. The final reflection is linking theory and practice. So going to the epistemological contentions, to you, Mark, in your recent work on urban policy failure, Going Bust in Two Ways, discusses the epistemological contentions between urban geography's investment in critical social theory versus public policy discipline's primary concern on how to generate desired changes of here and now. How and in what ways are these two epistemologies different? And for non-academic listeners, could you differentiate epistemology versus ontology? Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Inji, and thanks for everyone being involved in this today. I'm looking forward to the discussion. Sure, that means to the last part of your question. As briefly as I can put it, I guess. Epistemology is the philosophy of knowledge. So it asks questions like, what is the nature of knowledge? What is the source of knowledge? How do we justify our beliefs? What are the possibilities of knowledge? What types of knowledge are there? So ask questions about knowledge. How do we know things? Ontology is the philosophy of existence or being. So it essentially asks, what is in the world? You can go right back to the ancient Greeks and see Socrates asking these types of questions. For example, you might try and categorize the world up into things which are concrete, like a tree, a material substance, or something which is abstract, like an idea. They all exist in the world, but what is there? What are the differences between them? So these are philosophical distinctions. And my work on urban policy failure came out of an attempt to try and understand the differences in explanation which were emerging principally in the US about urban governance after the Great Recession. And in dealing with the two literatures, one in geography, which was more critically orientated, and the other in public policy, one of the ways I could explain the difference between these two literatures was by thinking about the ways in which they enact different types of reasoning. And very in broad strokes, I think what you find is that literature in critical urban studies and geography tends to think about theoretical reasoning, and that is concerned with trying to explain causation, what's causing city governments to act in particular ways. And the public policy scholars are more interested in questions of how to act, and that's more concerned with what would be called practical reasoning. And I wanted to think about the distinction between those two knowledges. And one way to think about that is a distinction between practical and technical knowledge. And so this is a distinction which the philosopher Michael Oakeshott talks about. So a good example is if you think about buying a cookbook, say, Anthony Bourdain's cookbook, right? You buy the book, and it involves, it's got a set of instructions into how to make a dish of whatever type. And the probably the expectation you have is, but in by buying the book, it doesn't make you the a greater chef as Anthony Bourdain was, because it gives you technical knowledge. It tells you what to do, but in order to make the dish in the same way, there's a different type of knowledge, which you can't, I mean, Oakeshott claims you can't write it down. It's practical knowledge. It's tacit, it's practiced. And I think what, going back to urban studies, I think what public policy scholars try and do is to tap in much more to that idea of the practical knowledge at play, whereas critical geographical and urban scholars have been more concerned with the technical. And that creates just different modes of explanation, and in fact, different objects of inquiry. So when there are debates about bringing these two things together, and the point of that paper is essentially to argue what you're trying to bring together, or to keep my food analogy going, are apples and oranges. They may not be compatible. They may just simply be different types of knowledge. There may be barriers in the ways in which different people who are looking at the same thing construct different forms of knowledge.
Just a quick question so what are the pros and cons of each epistemology?
That's a difficult question to answer, because there's worth in both, and it kind of depends on what you want to know. And the object of inquiry that you are looking at, and the quality of the scholarship involved in each. So you need both. What public policy scholars are trying to do, they're trying to help people who are actually practicing. And there's an orientation towards that. Type of community and the priorities of that, and critical scholars attending to talk to other critical scholars. So it's hard to say pros and cons. They're just doing different things. And the utility of each of those I think varies over time. I think I'm a bit of a relativist with that. They're discrete forms of knowing, which in what realm that is applicable, we'll maybe come on to talk to a little bit later, but I tend to kind of hesitate to say that one is better than the other. They're just trying to do different things. They're different tools.
Right. That's true. But Prince, I think your comparison with different epistemologies are a little bit different, but you know, in a similar vein, in the sense that the worldview differences that you highlight in your work on incompleteness of urban structure, urban infrastructure, because you talk about kind of the Western modernity, kind of there's an end goal that you have to achieve, and then you emphasize the fact that we have to go beyond the universalizing solutions to processes of infrastructure, infrastructure heterogeneity. Perhaps better to see infrastructures as emergent, shifting, and thus incomplete. So I think you kind of really underscore the existence of heterogeneity of different modernities and technologies that are currently underrepresented in Western-driven academic discourse. What do you think this implies for researchers who are interested in exploring Southern cities, but not necessarily from Southern cities? And how do we go beyond extracting data out of South to populate the same theoretical framework towards research practices that can have generative value in livelihood concerns in the South?
Yes, thank you very much, Inge, for really setting this up. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Yeah, so I mean, for me, the contribution that I was trying to make in this paper, first and foremost, I think for me, it was really about me trying to draw from my own observations of work in policy and research circles, especially work that tends to depict urban infrastructure heterogeneity as always being, you know, synonymous with failure or brokenness. And so I wanted to critique this, you know, often subtle expectations of infrastructures. You know, the idea that infrastructure should always evolve in a linear trajectory from less complete to more complete arrangements. And therefore, I refer to tendencies, to these kinds of tendencies as a kind of completist lures and inclinations that ought to be opposed. And it is upon this that I make the case for the notion of the incompleteness that you just mentioned. As you know, so I, you know, draw on this concept as a constitutive feature of infrastructures in transition, especially those that, while diverging from the so-called norms and ideals, cannot be described as failed, but as something else completely. You know, the points that Mark was trying to draw, you know, upon, you know, the ideas of tacit and practiced and practical knowledge, and, you know, the technical knowledge, the different forms of knowledge becomes really important. And especially it becomes important for us in trying to understand the different kinds of modernities. And so within the broader and global policy world or policy making processes, it also becomes the case that there is, you know, this wider critique. So the wider critique that I just mentioned of tends to seems to really extend, you know, within these kinds of circles themselves. And so there is a general urge and desire to conceptualize infrastructures or infrastructure projects through a kind of globally sanctioned trademarks of what a modern infrastructure or modern infrastructure project should be or should look like. And so here again, the infrastructures that diverge from the preferred ideal of modernity often tend to be disparaged, but also, you know, generally, you know, identified as it being deficient, defective, unsophisticated, less developed, and so on. So I really want to completely agree with you regarding what, you know, the core argument here is, which is, you know, respecting the heterogeneity of different modernities and technologies, particularly those that are currently underrepresented within the so-called global South. And so I think that we need to completely demystify this heterogeneity beyond proposals that disparage situated processes of development that diverge from the norms and ideals of, you know, what you refer to as the Western modernity. And so just to answer your other part of the question regarding, you know, researchers interested in exploring African cities, but are not from Africa. I think this also extends to, you know, African researchers as well, who might be interested in, different kinds of contexts and so on. So for me, this really calls partly for aligning with a kind of, you know, postmodern enterprise. So rather than, reproaching unfamiliar and strange infrastructures and development processes as attempts to, in the urge to really disentangle them, I think that it is important to better understand them and to see them for what they really are. And this means trying to see the value in their own abilities to transform urban lives, to transform urban infrastructures and so on. Thus, I think that we cannot just, you know, be normative about what's happening in these cities, in this case, African cities, but we need to be trying really to go beyond the language of, you know, the normative And so we need to go beyond essentialist and judgmental overtones. And I think for me, as you know, an emerging scholar and so on, I think for me, this really is about departing from a kind of dominant Euro-American traditions towards engaging a more nuanced discourse, especially one that brings the locals into a critical, innovative, and situated engagement.
Awesome. So more on the process and observation than the end goal. Smriti, related to this matter, in your conversation with me before, we talked about the aesthetics of city making and you know, how some development agencies' unilateral understanding of what's beautiful or aesthetic can be sometimes patronizing and sometimes not very useful. So could you give us some of the examples of these dynamics of who decides aesthetics, etc., and how that relates to your work in practice at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Inji. This is a topic very close to my heart. This is a question, actually, that duty bearers need to ask themselves. The reality of our cities today is that more than 50% of its people live in informality. They build cities from below. Now, design and aesthetics and placemaking has often been quite romanticized in theory. However, in practice, this is seldom the case when in case of pro-poor designs. Let's pick up, for instance, housing designs, because that's done in mass numbers across the globe. Now, pro-poor housing solutions are patronizing in many ways, because when housing is built for the poor, or when the poor are facilitated with housing, they're often seen by decision makers as beneficiaries of a project, and they're very rarely seen as partners of city making. Mm-hmm. So in many cases, we would observe that design solutions are like cookie cutters. You know, they rarely speak to the context. All the fundamentals of space, light, ventilation are completely compromised. So it's mostly like a tick box exercise, you know. So it's to say that it's to ask rather that don't poor have notions of aesthetics and aren't they rightful city makers? So in our practice, we have seen that such myopic visions have been challenged and that design of the commons is the oldest practice. And there is a lot of architecture without architects that have built cities in generations. They've been built over time with local resources that are affordable and solutions that have seen scale. Hence, the key in observing how aesthetics are defined and perceived lies in the way people build, you know, their people build and come up with local solutions.
Fascinating. So related to this kind of, you know, which epistemology is better or worse, or maybe it's not even the question of which one is better, but I kind of the kind of discrimination sometimes is needed to practice. So the second topic is how do we decide or who decides what is good or bad planning or good or bad development? And just to, before jumping into discussion, I'm just curious, just like in one or two sentences, how would you define the word development, going from Mark, Prince and Smriti? Mark, how would you define development, the word development?
For me, I think development is probably best thought of as a act of problem solving. And I think that would align, I think, with the ways in which I think about some of the moral and normative dimensions that that Prince and Smriti have just talked about. So I would plump for the idea of problem solving.
Problem solving, cool. Prince, how about you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't really agree more. But for me, what I could possibly add is that beyond that, it should be a kind of development that is really, you know, or in this case, a kind of problem solving that, you know, considers, you know, the situated realities, but is also not as such that it follows a linear trajectory. I think that's really what I could add onto what Max just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Smriti?
Yeah, I think development is a response to expand mm-hmm. on people's choices. Mm-hmm. That is how I could best think of development, because anything that is in the name of development is to actually expand on what people want, what choices that they bring out.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. We're going to talk about that soon. But to you, Mark, just going back to you, I was really fascinated by your article, the recent article in City, published in City on David Hume. And you kind of talk about morality and where we should find the origins of deciding what's good or bad. And as a bit of spoiler, you conclude that stressing the importance of understanding cultural and social conventions that could help mediate tension between reason and passion. What are the key insights from reading Hume, tracing the genealogy of good and bad, and what would that imply for an engaged urban geography research going forward?
Yeah, so I guess I'm one of the few people who's engaged with Hume in recent years, in at least in geography, and I think Hume is incredibly underappreciated across the social sciences. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that Hume says really does align with some of the things we've just talked about. So Hume is a kind of skeptic of the early Enlightenment, and particularly ideas around which we might put in the terms that Prince talks about, kind of linear modernities, which suggests another way of putting that is to say that we are becoming more and more reasonable over time, and that everyone should get on board the reasonable train. And Hume is deeply skeptical of that. One of the ways in which Hume does that is to say that the ways in which the ways in which Enlightenment thought has tended to think about reason is that it's something we have, it's something we should become more and more aligned with. And people like Rousseau, and to some extent Kant, are great exemplars of that. And Hume looks at himself principally and says, actually, reason is always playing second fiddle to the passions. And the things that actually motivate us are passionate attachments. So we kind of love things, we envy things, we get angry about things. Mm-hmm. These are things that motivate us. It's really hard to motivate someone through a reasoned argument. Usually we use rhetoric with regards to reason to appeal to passionate attachments. That's a kind of philosophical insight which is central to Hume's work. And the ways in which I think that's important for critical urban study and geography in the paper that you mentioned is really based around the idea that much of critical urban scholarship has been orientated towards a critique of reason. Another way of saying that is a lot of urban scholarship has been concerned with what we call neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And there is much that can be said about that concept, but essentially that is a diverse array of critical scholarship which tries to expose the irrationalities of an approach to city-making, world-making more generally, which is based on reasoned argument. So neoliberalism is a great example of Enlightenment thinking, that everyone should become more aligned with this kind of form of reasoning, that institutions should look like this. And of course, the moment we're living in and what the paper is responding to is a moment of populism. Mm-hmm. And populism isn't based in reason in the same ways in which neoliberalism is as a doctrine. It's quite apparent to anyone, I think, to look at the promises that populists make, which is quite clear they can't keep those promises. They are deep inconsistencies within those. And that doesn't matter because they're really appealing to desires, to passions. And I think that's a different object of analysis. So as our cities look more and more populist, as they become inheritors of national populist politics, and as mayoral candidates embrace the populist politics, that's a different thing to critique. And Hume gives us great insight into that. And his response is essentially, don't get fooled by trying to come up with a more reasoned argument to think this is playing out in reason, that you have to think about cultivating the passions that motivate us in more civilized ways. And I think I end the paper with an example from Orwell, which came to mind when I was writing the paper, that Orwell, writing, I think it's after World War II, I think it's 48, he writes about nationalism. And Orwell is kind of critical of the left at the time, who is very much kind of internationalist and opposed to the nation. And actually, Orwell's point is people are deeply attached to the idea of a nation. And his proposal is quite human in the sense that he thinks what he calls patriotism, which is, I'm going to butcher the quote here, but he says that to be a patriot is to believe your country is better than it is the best country, but no better than any other. It's to have pride, but not some kind of hierarchical pride. And that's a very human answer to, like, you have to recognize that populist cities are appealing to things which are the things that motivate people. And Hume doesn't think, and he's in great opposition to hear someone like Rousseau, who believes Rousseau kind of, to quote Rousseau, I think people have to be forced to be free. They have to be forced to be reasonable. And Hume fundamentally disagrees with that. So what I'm trying to think about in that paper, when it comes to going back to your question about what is good and bad, is that probably doesn't play out in terms of the types of kind of intellectual contest about reason and theoretical reason that we have got used to practicing, that we've got used to appealing to passionate scholarship, right? So you can say, look at this neoliberalism in the city, it's terrible. There's no trickle-down economics. The poor are becoming more impoverished. And here's an example, here's a narrative, here's a story. That's a passionate appeal to an unreasonable set of ideas. But populism switches that. And so I think we need to think pretty deeply about how we engage with critique in a world which is moving away from at least the veneer, at least the justification of certain things based on the idea that it is more reasonable.
Fascinating. Related to these prints, I think your work kind of criticizes on this mainstream modernity. But what I find it also interesting is that there the relational constitution between the mainstream and heterodox. So the mainstream only exists insofar as heterodox exists, and heterodox exists only insofar there is a mainstream, which we would think that that's the Western modernity. As you say, that the contingency of infrastructure are assemblages of social, political, economic, and technical negotiations, both trivial, significant, mundane, and strange. So what does this relational constitution between mainstream and heterodox mean for official policy actors as well as the people who work in the peripheries of urban governance?
Yes, thank you, Henry. I think this idea of, you know, who decides a good and bad planning, you know, at the heart of it, of course, is, you know, for whom is urban planning, you know, being made, and to what end, you know, so the motives and, you know, obviously so many other irrationalities involved in how, you know, some of these processes tend to be shaped. But I think for me, what this really is about, you know, the concept of who decides good or bad planning, I think for me, it's really about, you know, attention to different modes of ordering, because, I mean, there are always going to be different angles of, you know, what bad or good planning is, and for whom that, you know, is good or bad. But I think appreciation to different modes of ordering becomes really important. So the dynamic between the mainstream and heterodox and the relational constitution of the two here becomes really important. Because for me, really, I think that a lot of what is happening in the global south, and I think everywhere else for that matter, is not a process that necessarily manifests through a contrast, you know, of, you know, good or bad, failure or success and so on. But it's rather, I think these realities often tend to be embedded and also located in a mode of practice that is always shaped through mostly, in this case, you know, if you're talking about cities, through mostly resident initiated processes that sometimes tend to even transcend, you know, the state. So some of these, you know, developments might, you know, sometimes appear to be irrational for some actors, but in actual sense, they're really not, they're really not irrational, and they are shaped by, you know, different kinds of, you know, urban lives or livelihoods and so on. So how people interact with infrastructures, technologies, development projects and so on is often going to be determined by, you know, the contingency, you know, that you just mentioned. And this is in addition to, you know, political and, you know, economic conditions, you know, social aspects and other, you know, technological articulations and so on. And this, you know, can always be trivial or significant. They can be mundane or strange. But either way, an infrastructure project or technology and so on, they're always going to be shaped or, you know, their shaping is always going to be dependent upon some of these factors. Hence the fact, the reason why projects tend to be always contingent. And in the face of this, yes.
No, I was just wondering, what do you think of this reason and passion, this, this tension between reason and passion? How does that play out in your case in contingent infrastructures?
Yes, I mean, so reason and passion, I think it really plays out in more, in different kinds of calculations that drive, you know, different actors to, you know, how they react to an infrastructure project that just came into their neighborhood, for instance. You know, so the different kinds of calculations and speculations that inform different actors' response to something that just came into their lives. It could be a technology or an infrastructure and so on. Or it could even be, you know, a response to a government policy and so on. But I think for me, it's really more about these kinds of, you know, very minute, you know, calculations and speculations that often come into play to inform people's, you know, actions regarding how they interact with something that just came into their lives.
I thank you. And relatedly, Smriti, one of my favorite parts of your TED talk, you mentioned that, quote, poverty changes affordability, but not aspirations, unquote. You therefore conclude that how to broaden their choices should be at the heart of our work, or, you know, researchers or practitioners' work, rather than us choosing what's right for the poor. What kind of knowledge or knowledge-making processes do you think could help everyday professionals in concocting such menus for everyday communities to choose from?
Yeah, I think, you know, that also comes in response with the reflection of the topic itself of what, who decides what's good or bad planning. In neoliberal cities, power, positionality, politics and people decide most of it. People are often left behind. There's a whole argument about how power appropriates what is good and bad and what works and what doesn't work. So that same thing reflects in terms of aspirations. The challenge is that, you know, poor people like what they see around just like anybody else. they have very similar aspirations, but it's often misunderstood when professionals look down upon what people need and then go around building, something that's completely low-cost solutions, coming up with ideas that they think works for people, but it's probably not what they want. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, unarguably, affordability is definitely a constraint in a lot of communities. Mm-hmm. But what that means is that there are solutions in local knowledge, which is very advanced, and it's much more adaptable and sustainable. It has stood the test of time, and that millions of people use it is the evidence to acknowledge that it has worked. The role of professionals here is then to expand on that local knowledge and bring technical advancements to improve on what exists instead of doing the other way around. There is a opportunity for co-production. Now, this is a term that's quite often used in research, but very rarely understood in practice. So simply, let's say, for instance, we talk about standards all the time. A lot of people in reality use second-handed material to build their houses or build their places. These materials or this method of construction is probably not listed in the codes of construction practices. But, 40% of large cities are being built by people are being built like that. So accepting that, as professionals, that's the reality, and that kind of reality is challenging is the first step. And how to broaden those solutions that may be acceptable in everyday practice is actually the gap that professionals need to bridge. Because whether we like it or not, whether we accept it or not, whether our standards accept it or not, people are going to build it anyway.
Right.
So it's time that aspirations also come to reality, and that it's affordability that's the problem. It's not aspirations that is a problem.
Awesome.
Jinji, if I can just jump in there, I think it's a really good example of when you, with reference to good or bad and how you think about those categories, and then when you impose this distinction between practical and technical knowledge on it, then there is a tendency to preference the technical.
Absolutely.
At the cost of the practical. And that's something quite inherent within the kind of intellectual position, the preference of the technical, the bookshelf, that type of knowledge, which has it, of course, has its place, but it gets elevated, and we assume it's a very powerful form of knowledge, and we can assume that it overrides the practical, and that's it's a certain perspective, and it's sometimes also Humean, that the ways in which different communities have managed to think about condition and develop conventions to solve social problems can be overridden completely by a certain elevation of technical knowledge. And we see that in that's not limited to urban planning. That's a societal condition. And moving away from that is difficult because it's not an either or, right? You need to bring them into dialogue with one another, but it means, as Shmuchi says, a kind of a fairly radical shift in the ways that we've tended to bring expertise into certain problem-solving exercises. And unless we have these kind of distinctions, it's very hard for us to take what I think is a quite modest position in the type of knowledge we have and produce into bridging this kind of connections we're talking about today.
Yeah, that's awesome. Prince, would you have any comment on that?
I completely agree Mark.
Yeah, Angie, just to conclude on that note on what Mark said is that, technical knowledge has been very traditional and very rarely it's ever been questioned or challenged. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody is just, following some of those things in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And that practice has not necessarily challenged these, technical advancements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a real sociology to that, right? So technical knowledge requires something like the university or something like that to emerge and develop. And that's where we, on a sociological basis, that's where we've tended to put expertise or people who know stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's not where all knowledge resides, but it's been socially elevated. And unfortunately, I think many of us tend to buy that completely, and we shouldn't. One of the dominant impressions I have when I go out and do work in cities, do research, is how little I know and how little I have to contribute usually, despite a stock of technical knowledge. And I think that's a hazard of the occupation, but it's a sociological hazard too. So we're going to elevate it to a position of expertise, but that doesn't mean an expertise in everything, even the things that we're an expert in. And so dealing with the sociology of that is a particularly challenging part of bridging the gap between theory and practice.
Yeah, this really links smoothly to the final topic that I wanted to ask you. Relatedly, Mark, I'd like to know your experience from engaging more with the European radical thinkers such as Rancière, and now more with American pragmatism such as Rorty, and what that implied to your research work in practice. And also, what do you think of the tension between scholarly versus engaged and Archimedean globe view versus situated?
Right, so there's a lot there. I mean, I would describe my theoretical engagements as being rather eclectic, and that, as you say, has involved kind of continental European radical traditions and American pragmatists like Rorty and many others besides. One of the things I think I've learned from that work, I guess two impressions. The first one immediately, there's something that Rorty says about philosophy and theory generally, which I can't quite shake. And it's he says most of the things that we discuss in philosophy and theory have actually no practical relevance outside of the seminar room. That's not to dismiss them. They're important. But when it comes to pragmatism, it comes to practice, they're not really relevant. And I think we tend to intellectualize things and think there are intellectual solutions to things which there aren't. And so it implies a certain limit to things. And that's, I think, a very difficult thing to negotiate, because in a seminar room, you're talking about explaining all the world around us and coming up with these big theoretical explanations. And I don't want to dismiss those. Those are important, but there are real limits. And I think Rorty is fairly brave to suggest something like that. And so I appreciate that for sure. And I guess the other thing that I learned by working across traditions is the partiality of any perspective, and in some sense that's Hume's skepticism of the Enlightenment thinking, right? The kind of linearity of it, and the importance of reading the contrary opinion, right? As soon as you start to agree with something, you should run away to the hills and read everything that disagrees with that opinion. We are, I forget who said it, but we are dogma prone from the womb. So I reading across, those are things that on a theoretical basis that relate to me. And on a the latter part of your question around theory and practice, I guess one of the things that I've learned reading across relates back to where we started in terms of epistemology. Mm-hmm. And as an urbanist, we're dealing with an incredibly complicated thing, the city. Mm-hmm. And as a kind of epistemological inquiry, there are different aspects to the city which enable us to produce different types of knowledge. And Karl Popper has a really interesting notion here, that in terms of thinking about social science and what we can know, And he divides the world up into kind of what he calls three worlds or three ontologies. And there are aspects of the social world which fall into his third category, world of ontology. And but those are kind of regularized things, things that you could produce. I mean, he doesn't suggest it's a purely scientific explanation, but you can produce something like predictable theories. But those are mainly kind of institutional things. So the cities are, if you like, a set of regulated regularities, right? There are things that we kind of institutionalize. But there are also many other things in a city which you can't put into that group. And so when you think about urban scholarship, I think one of the things I've learned reading across different theorists and being engaged with epistemology is that you should really always be asking, what kind of knowledge can I produce? What kind of theories can I produce about the thing that I'm looking at? Popper's suggestion is that we should always be developing what he calls the kind of boldest conjectures, the boldest hypothesis we can. And that is, if you like, grand theories of. Because they may be out there. You may be able to say that in the world of kind of institutionalized urban development, there are certain regularities that we can theorize about. And I think we do a lot of that, right? There is theory is elevated pretty high in terms of what we value in academic knowledge. The part of it that we tend to miss, I think, is the other part of Popper's formulation, which is refutations. We don't test our theories very much. Much of them would reside in the kind of pseudo-scientific, that they are more abstract explanations. And I think that's when you run into the gap to practice, because I think it's probably a pretty regular occurrence for a junior scholar to go out imbued with a theoretical explanation and then find themselves in the world of practice, and people will just look at you and think, what are you talking about? This is just so abstract. Yeah. And it's not clear to me that the things you are saying are causing us to do what we're doing are actually there at all. And I think one of the ways you can get around that is to think about, well, the theory that I've produced, how can I validate it in one way or another? That's not to say that all urban theory should be scientific in that sense. But I think when you're talking about practice, I think there is a much more greater emphasis on having really strong, verified explanation that can then be articulated to people in practice. So going back to my summary answer there is, I think the link between theory and practice, it depends on what you're looking at, and it depends on the type of theory you're trying to produce. It may be something that we can't all strive for, this connection, and it may be like different projects give us a different opportunity to do so. That's what I like about Rorty. That's what the idea that a lot of things we're discussing in terms of theory may be really important in our own field, but that's where they should stay, and that's fine. But I think it tends to be hard to resist the temptation because of the incentives of the occupation in many ways to stretch a little bit beyond that realm. Between working across these thinkers, I've probably become a bit more modest in my own work because of them.
Awesome. Prince, do you have any comment on that? And also related to that, your role, kind of the brokerage role between external scholars coming from different backgrounds and you as a person actually living in the South. So you probably run into a lot of Western scholars or other scholars really filled with certain theoretical angers that are quite different from the Southern realities. And I'd love to know what your experience is on that.
Yes, thank you, Indri. First, I just wanted to sort of like provoke Mark to think about before we actually begin to think about theory and practice. I think we need to think about whether we actually have the right theories. And if we do not, how do we think about theory and practice? Because I think there is really an assumption that there are actually theories one would think reflect the realities on the ground. But sometimes some theories tend not to actually, play this role. I just wanted to ask this question, if we actually have theories and, or if this is something that needs to be addressed first before we could be able to speak about, theory and practice. Regarding your question, for me, really, I think it has been an experience of, unlearning as much as learning. In my work, there are times, even within, like in Nairobi or in Kampala, the cities that I have researched a bit, quite more. There are times I feel, like I'm an external scholar in one way or another. So I think this question really, has, it has implications for any scholars, regardless of whether they are external scholars or not. Right. And so it's always going to be a process of, unlearning as much as it is a process of learning. And in my methods, I've had to follow networks, both tangible and intangible. I've tried to be, I've had to learn how to be open, to different kinds of articulations. So that means different modes of practice, modes of being in the world. I think that it becomes really important to be open to these kinds of, other realities. But most importantly, I've come to, gain a better grasp of the inherent incompleteness of knowledge itself. And at the same time, appreciate and be open to the plurality of knowledge. And that this is about understanding that things can coexist. Just to go back to your question regarding the current direction of a global scholarship. So how I see it, really, I don't think there is a single direction to global scholarship. I think there are, different directions and, of course, various scholars growing from different perspectives. So then it becomes really important for us to understand that things can always coexist, including knowledge. So I do not really believe in the idea of a single direction of global scholarship. Even within urban studies, I think that there are many directions. In all of this, however, I believe that there is so much that global scholarship can offer to research and policy practices of grounded realities, such as those that I'm experiencing in Eastern Africa. So for instance, scholarship, I think, or I believe could perhaps be, more open to different forms of mobilization and sociability and modes of interdependence. And it could also perhaps try to offer more better explication of the molecular details of everyday lives. Because for me, I believe that this is where the innovation lies. And I think that essentially it becomes really important for us as scholars to perhaps in our work be more propositional in how we explicate, these aspects of everyday lives and, different interactions and interfaces. And so we need to be open to other forms of articulation, wherever this might be. But at a more grand scale, I think that we need to think of, possibilities of, decolonizing, you know, pedagogies, or, you know, at least being more open to more diverse pedagogies. And of course, you know, this really draws into what Mark already mentioned about, you know, the populist movements and, you know, the points by Smriti. You know, more voice to the people becomes really important rather than, you know, going beyond these regimes that tend to silence different sections of societies. It becomes important for us to, you know, draw ourselves more towards pluriversal approaches, particularly those within the margins, and, you know, think of planning as something that can be transformative, take place and context into consideration. But finally, you know, be more attentive to articulations that exceed the language of the normative.
Thank you, Prince. Just a quick question to you, Mark, on Prince's provocation on what decides kind of what kind of if we're just talking about in terms of theories, good or bad theories, does it happen only in that theoretical circle, or could it be tested as an experiment on the ground?
Yeah, it's provoking. I think there are, I mean, we could probably talk about this for days on end, but I think Prince said, do we have the right theories? And I think there's something that I'm resistant to that framing. I think the search for the right theory is essentially a theological position. That's not to say, I think actually a lot of scholarship has that theological orientation. I think we can talk about better theories, better explanations, without ever aiming or expecting that we'll arrive at the right one. And I think there are lots of reasons why we might think that. I do think there are better explanations and theories out there. I think some things are more settled than others. So I think we have a vast inheritance of theoretical developments, scientific developments, which are useful and remain useful. And I don't think we're involved in a process of trying to figure out the right way to understand things. I think I'm much more inclined to take the kind of non-essentializing scientific approach that we should continue to be looking for a better way of doing things, whether that's theory in a kind of theoretical reason sense or it's practice in a practical reason sense. And how we decide on what is better is, it aligns more with a Humean approach that, well, we need to figure out if this is a more civilized and productive way of doing things than it used to be, not necessarily the right one. Because I think searching for such essentials theoretically in any sense, it appeals to the worst of our theoretical tendencies.
Yeah, it really resonates with the pragmatism focus on the reframing or kind of offering a new perspective. Could be also good theory. So it doesn't have to be maybe very, I mean, it's practical, it's useful and practical in some sense as a way of offering a new, fresh perspective or something.
Yeah, I think there are limits to the pragmatist approach. I think sometimes the better isn't practical, I think. One of the things I learned from engaging with someone like Rancière is the centrality of a notion of equality. That's not a claim that everyone is equal in any form or another, but in terms of their political status, that should be our approach. So I'm a Democrat above everything else in that sense. But I don't think that is often a practical, I think that's often a very difficult thing to work through. So I think there are real limits to the pragmatist approach, but I think there is also a great deal of merit in it. And perhaps it is ultimately a pragmatic approach to say, well, we need to figure out which is the best way to look at this particular problem we are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And that may not be necessarily pragmatic. It may be that there are some moral positions that you just have to hold and live with. But again, that's to be non-essential about those moral positions you're holding.
Awesome, thank you. I guess I would go to Smriti now that we are kind of running out of time. I just wanted to know, in your work, you not only advocate for the rights of citizens to occupy space that they currently reside in, but also you try to offer adequate strategies to manage the tension between the mainstream development activities versus those who hope to maintain their heterodox modes of being in the world. So would you share some of the stories of how such tensions were able to relieve in a kind of a just or equal or the kind of social justice way?
Yeah, sure. So in an ideal world, we would believe that the city is for everyone, and hence, you know, it should be just to all its citizens. What happens in the absence of formal structures or cities unable to fulfill to provide basics is where informality thrives. So, you know, the urban poor in most cases have always been put to test to demand their rights in the city. So, for example, the pavement dwellers in Mumbai, you know, around the 80s and 90s, there were rampant evictions and they were being evicted then and again. Well, pavement is not the place for people to sleep because it's for the city that's rightfully accepted. But then what happens when cities fail to give what is affordable, you know, to the marginalized? So the first generation of the Federation leaders, especially the women, they you know, identify themselves as the Mahila Milan. It translates as women together in English. So they negotiated with the city, with the laws, to not only look out for a piece of land in the city that belonged to public, let's say it's public land. Mm-hmm. It took them so many years in order to do those negotiations with the city. And they identified a piece of land and negotiated for it, also paid for the land, and saw building on that land, housing for themselves and for similar like people from the pavements end to end. So I think that changes the way we understand of, you know, how to resolve tensions. There's always a way to negotiate, and that's something that you know, leaders and Slum Dwellers Federation has always believed in, to work together with the city. You know, regarding the topic itself, the latter question, I think the critique with academic knowledge is that it's very esoteric to practice. You know, theory has a different purpose, and it deserves its acknowledgement. It comes from rationalized thinking. But the question that often people ask, so when we have researchers, we've had researchers coming all over the globe to work with us. The question that communities ask, you know, when sometimes in conversations when we discuss theories, is that if it cannot be realized in practice, then who are these theories helping? I mean, if it's helping build the knowledge base, then what is it of use to solving problems of people on the ground? Now, research is built with evidence, and there is little evidence of what people do themselves. The question, you know, talking about the practice and what research can bring back, is how much of research comes back to people? You know, that's a very fundamental question that I tend to ask a lot. You know, when we look out for research proposals, we're looking out for collaborations to work together. So I think it's time for academia to also come back to communities to give back what they found. So right. The information is always taken away, and that also comes from data extraction, from so many other discussions in academia. So what is all this data going to? Who is it serving, you know? It's to ask, you know, it's time that research and academia ask us to themselves to say, is there a way to go back to communities to tell them what they found with that big deal of information that was collected. And so that that information is also translated in local language so that data, you know, can be used by local communities to do whatever they like. They could use that data to plan better, to sometimes negotiate with municipalities. That's where collaboration and research comes from. And that's where we're talking about real partnerships. So the key there lies not only in writing academic papers, because that's you know, what sets up the standards for academicians, is, but it's also to see how, you know, it can come back to communities, what, how, you know, the findings come back to research. I think there's a whole deal of real ethics in research that lies there. So everywhere that we're working and we say, okay, fine, this is great. You want to do research and there are these different theories that you want to test, all that is fine. But then whatever you collect in the process together with people should come back to people in some way. So can you change your methods in a way that, you know, it helps people in some way, that there is a real contribution? And a simple way to look at it is that what kind of budgets or finances is allocated within research to do that? So there's a whole different thing about it, and we can go in it all together off the tangent to speak about it. But very briefly speaking, I think that that's how research can really, really help bring something to communities. And there's there's a big opportunity there because there's so much resources that goes in doing so much research.
Right. Coming back to the communities. Thank you so much. I'd like to kind of conclude by asking two questions to each speakers. So the first question is, what are your inspirations or sources of hope for political transformation in the context that you're familiar with? And the second question is, what political opportunities do the epistemological critics and practices that you refer to generate? Just a few sentences. Mark, starting from Mark.
Oh, they're rather big questions to finish up on. And I was kind of hoping you might ask Prince Rashmurti to answer them first. Look, I think there were well-intentioned people who want to enhance and protect the things that they love in their lives and their cities all over the place. And I would hope that that continues on. And I don't think any city is void of those forces. And I would like to think that they win out moving forward. In terms of epistemology, I guess I'd go back to kind of some of the things that Shmurti was saying, in that I think there are really important questions that the academy has to be asking itself about the work that it does and the work that it asks itself to do. And there is a sense in which there's been a race to the bottom, and that we are all asked to produce the same type of work. So all of our institutions want us to produce globally significant scholarship in one form or another. And that tends to the theoretical, tends to the abstract. And I think the danger in that is that it has an increasing distance from practice and from actual expertise on the object of analysis. So it is possible, I think, to live in a world of theoretical abstractions about the city, which just produces more echoes for the academic echo chamber.
Right.
And the worry that I have is that we've, in a globalized context that we've been living in, that essentially we've all been incentivized to produce that type of knowledge. And it's come at the cost of the academic who is incredibly well-versed in their local context, that is able to shepherd the intellectual and the theoretical into that context because of that expertise. And my worry is that that type of academic, that type of intellectual is less and less possible in the world that we live in. And so the type of knowledge we valorize and elevate and celebrate in the academy has to become much more diverse than it is currently.
Yeah, awesome. That's a really good point. Prince, would you agree? What do you think?
Yeah, of course. Of course, I completely agree. I mean, how can I not? I mean, also really well said, Mark. So for me, I think Smriti mentioned something about how we're dealing with a really complex thing, the city. And so it often seems to me like cities are always going to produce novel forms of urbanism, you know, regardless of how we might want to interpret them through a universal lens, you know, in some right. cases. I think this realization is really important and for me really inspiring to, you know, try to be really keen on what kind of knowledge am I looking for? Actually, what kinds of knowledges that am I looking for? And what is my contribution in all of this? And so in my research of, you know, urban infrastructure and, you know, smart technologies, I had, you know, the chance of researching about Nairobi for my PhD. And Nairobi is one city that is really, you know, highly fragmented and, you know, highly splintered. So regardless of how, you know, well-designed a project, you know, is going to be, as soon as it's deployed in Nairobi, it's always going to coexist with a large, you know, scale urban fragmentation and informality of Nairobi. And, you know, that it in itself speaks to, you know, the complexity of the city that we are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so I guess where else I draw inspiration from is the urge to speak to different kinds of temporalities, you know, the contingencies that you mentioned at first, the context specific conditions of cities. I think for me, this become really, really important concepts to even work with for my own work.
The emergent qualities that you highlight, right? It's emergent, yes. So it doesn't exist in theoretical abstraction because plural people are generating new realities every day, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so how do we really theorize that? How do we speak to that? And so actually my provocation to Mark wasn't really about a theory in and of itself, but I sort of really believe that first what we should be working towards is, you know, trying to find ways of better operationalizing theoretical pluralism. You know, just us being really sure that we have the right interpretations for the, different, the multitudes of, you know, urban worlds and realities. For me, that is a good point to start. And I think that's really where I draw, you know, inspiration. But that's really just to add on to what Mark just said.
Smriti?
You know, in the lives of poor people, especially where we work, they are so constrained by just being born poor that they have to stand up every day to stand up to their vulnerabilities.
Right.
And that itself gives a lot of inspiration, a lot of hope to say that there is anything, if there's anything that can be done in order to better their lives, in order to, you know, help them lessen the burden that they're facing anyway. So I think that is where a lot of inspiration and hope comes through to a lot of people, in fact. And I think even for academicians, they're trying to help build knowledge that they think would help some way change the way the world works. So I think that's where a lot of inspiration is to come.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Arthur Malik Simon's The Endurance of Rhythms. Like, it's the endurance of people that they kind of don't really have a lot of traditional or, you know, conventional resources per se, but they do have that kind of energy and endurance to go on their lives regardless of different circumstances that endanger their everyday livelihood.
Yeah. Like, you know, there are a lot of urbanists and researchers. You know, Appa Durai and Amartya Sen have spoken about aspirations and capacities of individuals to aspire. So there's so much capacities, you know, in individuals that they can change and they can do something. Professionals like us can just support to make that happen.
But also the social infrastructure, right? I mean, a lot of southern realities, we do still have the customs and social infrastructure that sustain the vulnerable livelihoods. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, Smuti. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Prince. Thank you, Ingie, for this thought-provoking conversation.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.